Welcome back to the Basketball Coaches Roundtable Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Newman. Today's guest to the roundtable is J.D. Walsh, a former University of Maryland basketball player, as well as overseas, and founder of the J.D. Basketball School. J.D., welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me in this rainy Wednesday here in New York. So happy to be around some esteemed coaches here and happy to talk some hoops.
Yeah, so let me go around and introduce who's sitting at the round table with you. You have Elle Green. She's the head coach of Beckham High School in Brooklyn. You have Jay Griffin, assistant coach at John Jay College in Manhattan. And you have Dan Murphy, assistant at Monmouth University. And of course, Dan is the one that introduced us all those years ago. So we each go around, we get one question of you, and I want to start because I know, to me, you have this really amazing story about what you've done with the game of basketball. I think as coaches, we talk a lot about using the game and not letting the game use you, and I feel like your journey, like you actually use the game in a very positive way and impacted a lot of people. And I think that's the ultimate goal of us as coaches, is to impact kids in a positive way. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I definitely resonate with the idea of using the game to help work people. And that's the magnet that keeps bringing me back to the core and center of being in the game and around the game. And it really stemmed from my dad and I think my family and the values that we were brought up with as far as being people in the world who serve others and try. Obviously for me, basketball has been that outlet, but in my family, my mom's an artist, she's used art. My sisters are both teachers at various levels. And for me, there was definitely the dreams of the bright lights, but the reality of the day-to-day of just being in and around the game is really just such a blessing. And you never realize, and I've had some time now that I've stopped coaching essentially a team on a day-to-day basis, and I realize how prolific the effect is on coaches, especially the college and high school level, on people, forget basketball players, but all of the people, especially I've seen first and foremost from my dad, who was a heck of a coach at Babylon High School in Long Island and had coached McDonald's All-Americans down to, you know, the guy who never got off the bench, who's a fisherman, or another guy's teaching at Yale, for example, it doesn't matter. They all come back and they see him and they talk about how important he was in their life. And now, even though I don't have any gray beards like Dan yet, I get some of that too from my time at coaching at St. John the Baptist in Long Island and other places around the world. And it's part of the cycle of life, and you put your energy in the world and it's nice to see when it comes back, and hopefully it mirrors off of someone else and it continues to grow. And I do think that is one of the best purposes for sport, is to be a part of that. So as you know, all of us coaches are kind of like artists in a way, and this is our art form, our communicative form. I mean, and this is a great avenue to do that. Like, you can't do it. I couldn't do it, for example, with maybe a pen and a paper or a canvas, but you can definitely do it with a ball and people, and try to teach them values of hard work. And reality is too, we're all learning from each other. I learned so many things from the kids I worked with, and to not be open-minded to other ideas, then it wouldn't even help my own self-evolution. So that, but I was lucky. I mean, I can expand a little bit on my experience if you like, or.
No, I mean, I'd love to hear more about, because you took your school, you know, essentially globally, and this was, you know, especially to places where the NBA hasn't reached at that time, and you're kind of like a pioneer. I mean, you were in China, and I know you did a lot of things in India. I mean, if you can expand on that, I think it'd be great.
Sure. The root of everything that I did started in a small gym in Port Washington with five kindergartners at 22, 23 years old. I'd come back from coaching, playing overseas for a while, and then I was working on Wall Street. I hated every minute of it, and I wanted to coach, so I tried to supplement my income with training. And back then, you know, you guys are so young, but the internet had actually just started. It'd be rare to even have a website or a mailing list of a sophisticated form. I mean, Excel was there, but so when I started, I was doing all the training myself, and I built it out to a pretty fairly substantial, but not, I mean, everything's relative, but it was a nice small business, we could say. I mean, I had all of Great Neck Public Schools. I had maybe 10 sites by the end of it from Manhattan out to the Hamptons. And I started coaching at Roslyn High School my first year. We had a very good year. And then I got hired at St. John the Baptist, where I stayed for 6 years and built out the program. And I think we had 7 Division I players in that time. But from the camp perspective, the base was teaching life skills through sports at a very high level. And that was always the idea of what I wanted to do. And when the camp started growing, it allowed me the time and freedom to work on other kinds of things. About 5 years into being at St. John the Baptist, it just so happened the girls coach there, Ted Oberg, his name is, he was a very well-known girls coach. His day job was an auctioneer, like a Sotheby's. And I said, yeah, you know, we made some money with these camps. I want to invest it. I don't know anything about this stuff. What can we do? And he said, well, I'm bringing in these containers from China and you can split it with me and I'll do it. And he said, okay. That never happened, by the way. But what did happen was that we connected with friends of his whom had a relationship unbeknownst to me with the central governing body in China. So I, at 26, 27, was privy to be part of sort of a global, business. Like, we had a better relationship at that time than, frankly, the NBA did in China, because only that the head of the league who makes the decision, so if you think about a pyramid, the top of the pyramid person, was a direct long-term relationship with one of our business partners. And we came out with a very historic agreement to help basically spread goodwill between the US and China. But underneath that had to do with a series and opportunities and opening of doors to run camps, clinics, and games throughout China. So I coached against the national junior team of China throughout China. I mean, 25,000 people, I think. A couple million people watched it on TV, and I brought teams over there, and I did that for a long time. And in a way, that was pioneering. Nobody was doing that. The NBA was still working on getting their TV deal, which eventually they did, but this predates Yao Ming. So that was one of my first forays, but more so just being a New Yorker, as I think all of us are tied to New York, we meet people from all cultures, all religions, all everything. And the reality is that I was always interested in people, and I'm interested in new ideas. So when I started going to China and getting an invitation, once I got an invitation to go to the Dominican Republic to train the national team, I would go. Anyone asked me to go somewhere, I was on the plane, I was going. And I would just start by doing something where they would have me go, and then of course I'd meet someone and say, okay, well, why don't I just run a camp here, or why don't I try to figure it out? And that led to working and doing things in maybe 9 or 10 countries. I was on the road quite a long time. I did a ton of work in anointed camps in Italy. I did a lot of work in Israel for Maccabi Tel Aviv, and that led to doing some scouting. I did so many different things around the game. And it really started with just knowing how, I would say, to teach the game, and then showing a dual interest. As an American, there's this idea that we're all arrogant and we're not interested in other cultures. So when a lot of these other foreign bodies would come to me and I'd work with them, I'd be interested to see what they do. And then when they realized that I was interested in learning, they would open up a lot of doors for me. So I would get in and get a chance to go. And in 2007, around 2005 to 2007, when I stopped coaching and we were growing a China business, I had gotten, I started getting really interested in using sport. Now it's kind of a, you know, a code word, but like I used to do sport for good before it was really sport for good. Now there's players for peace and all of that. But I used to go stuff to places. So I went to a lot of conflict regions around the world just on my own and teamed up with a local nonprofit and would do the work of just not making it complicated, but doing camp, really. Same thing I was doing in a gym in Long Island with five kindergartners, but doing it maybe a higher level. And, you know, it grows. I was working with Israeli and Palestinian kids, and I was working with, and I went to Kashmir, where my wife's family is from, to work with orphaned youth from an earthquake. It's a very political hotbed now, still today. I had gone to work in so many, and even in the city. I mean, I worked in the Bronx with the Boys and Girls Club. I mean, anywhere I could do something like that, I would do it. Because I love to do it. And I got a chance to do some stuff and speak at the UN and to a lot of the development banks, the World Bank, and, you know, so around 2007, I got an invitation. Coincidentally, it was just kismet, really. I was actually in Tel Aviv. I remember when I got the email, there was this boy in India. He said, look, I want to be the first Indian ever in the NBA. Would you be willing to come to India? And I'm like, come on, man, India. So the first thing I did, because I'm also an entrepreneur, is I Googled India basketball in 2007. Nothing came up, like nothing. Like the third search, not even the third page, didn't even have India and basketball together. That's where how off they were on the map. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I'd just been in China for 4 years, of a country of 1 billion people. It's basketball crazy, and it's hard to work there for a myriad of reasons. Let's take a chance on India. And then just so happened, I got back to New York, and it's funny how life works sometimes, but my wife, then not even a girlfriend, just someone I knew, said, hey, I have this thing in Kashmir, the one I mentioned. She's like, would you want to go there? And I was like, yeah, I'll go. So it's like, well, I looked on a map. I'm like, Pune, India, Kashmir, they're not that far. I could fly into Mumbai. I could do this one. I could go back up. So I did it, not knowing when I got off the plane in Pune the first time that there was going to be like, I think 400 kids or some crazy number ready for me at like 6 a.m. because it's so hot in India to do a program at Ferguson College. And then there was a press conference of like 40 reporters. And it was like one of the first basketball camps done by an American or anyone in India. So from that, it sort of went, this state called, and that was with the state of Maharashtra. So if you think of New York State, Maharashtra is the state that has Bombay in it. It's a pretty populous and known state, English speaking state. And they said, in Hindi speaking state, Marathi speaking state. And they said, okay, you know, once it was in the paper, I was getting calls from everyone. And then I started doing a lot of work with the US Department of State as part of their diplomacy program. And at that time, I fell in love with India. I fell in love with the culture. I fell in love with the food. I fell in love with the life. It's a fascinating place, probably a podcast for another day. But there were several of us at that time. India was entering what business people call a blue ocean, where it was really just starting to open up, and had a middle class of 500 million people that now could buy, let's say, an air conditioner or a car. You know, it might be a Ford Fiat, but this is where they're. And I saw a lot commonality between India and China. So when I got off the plane, and we all know basketball, but fast forward now 13 years, is a long time ago, all of the different things that you could do in basketball, whether it be to creating an NCAA, to having a clothing and equipment line, to 100 different things. Some of you guys know what I'm saying. I'm a New Yorker, we would figure it out, you know? So I was doing all of that. I would attempt to do all that, which is not so easy to do in a foreign country, as I came to learn as an entrepreneur. But my ultimate goal to start was an entry level, and I had a shoe designed by a Nike designer that I was trying to deliver, piggybacking off of what Stefan Marbury did with the low-cost shoe, and I wanted to do a very similar thing. So I'd spent, and in the interim, you could call it brand building, but I was actually coaching and doing what I do. I did programs, I think, in 25 I don't know the exact number, 25, 27 cities throughout India. And India is a, even though it's not a huge landmass, it's about a third of the size of America. It's got 27 different languages, 27 different cultures. We're not that far removed from the partition in 49, where they moved the Muslims and the Hindus. And obviously there's like 50 other religions there and sects of both of those religions. To create Pakistan, East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. And I did programs all the way north to Mizoram, if you look where that is on a map, all the way down to Trivandrum, which is in the south in Kerala, and everywhere in between, Chennai and Mumbai and Delhi. And it was interesting. I got to work with the ambassador quite a bit. I did work and I won grant awards doing some nonprofit work. In fact, one of the programs was to work before, well, I had been working on it. It just so happened that late, like 2 years later, you win a grant, but in Dharavi. And Dharavi is the poorest slum in Asia, but it sits right into highest priced real estate in the world, basically. Think about if you put the projects in Central Park, that was Dharavi, but the people were just amazing. Their energy was amazing. Their love was amazing. And my idea was, there's nothing, I went there the first day, a friend of mine had a relationship with a guy named Jukim Apartam. And Jukim works for an organization called Spark, which is the slum redevelopment. So they were taking down buildings, building new ones and safer buildings for these people. But it's tricky because next door to there is a very politically challenged party, basically, that has no problem using violence to get what they need. So it was a constant struggle. So I said, look, I want to build the basketball court here, because the first day I saw kids swinging on what used to be an old electric line on two stop poles, and I'm like, stop sign poles rather. And they were like, what's the basketball court? Like, I'm like, okay. So the first time I'm out there, I'm showing them. And first thing that happens, this is my first trip ever to India. I hit my head. I got like 7 stitches in my head it's behind my hairline. You can't see it. That was my like introduction to India. And fast forward, I think 7-8 years later, and it had been 2 years when I was removed. So I was started the project, but I didn't continue with it. But they built it. They actually took it another level. They built what's called a gymkhana, which is more like, don't call it a country club, but for this sake, let's call it a country club, where they had like facilities. But so it's audacious for this social group to build it. So it's something that I was pretty proud of. It sparked an idea and spent a lot of time trying to do that. And I was in India till 2011, as you mentioned. Eventually the NBA came and they've done some great work in India. They teamed up with Reliance Sports, which was a group I was in negotiation with as well to do stuff. But obviously the NBA is the NBA. And it got really challenging to live there, frankly. I mean, for a myriad of reasons. I mean, that's a whole podcast probably on itself. So I came back in 2011 and I got married, and I've been based in New York ever since. And frankly, I've been doing on the basketball front, like you mentioned, I started doing color commentary for New York Tech, which is the ECC. I was scheduled to get some ESPN3 games, which would have been a step up last year, but then COVID hit. So I don't know what's going to happen this year, if I'm going to get the call or what's going to happen. And then I trained, NBA players. And then separately, I have another business in the real estate world that takes my time. And I have a 4-year-old daughter, which takes up the most important of my time. So that kind of leads me into today.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think this story is fascinating, and it really, I think one of the things that I got out of it all starts from just saying yes, and just like having these opportunities presented to you and just saying yes. And the fact that you're always going to be, you always get on the plane to go. If someone asks you, you're going to go. You're not turning down an opportunity. I think that's something that's key for everybody to hear. Do you have a question for JD?
Sure. JD, thank you. You expanded on a lot. So it was like, oh, my questions. Speaking of your self-evolution, when did you have the footing as a basketball mind? And I say a basketball mind because you've done so many things, and, you know, sport is the language that connects everything. When did you realize that you wanted to go to the next level in your craft? And what are the next levels of your craft?
That's a great question. One, the second part of that question is I'm still trying to figure that out. So the first part of the question was I played for some great coaches, including one that was in the Hall of Fame. So I've been around, not to mention my dad, who was a great basketball mind. Like, I've learned, when I coached St. John the Baptist, my dad, I brought him out of retirement, and he was my quote unquote assistant coach. But I was like 25 years old in New York. The Long Island Catholic League is a pretty good league. I mean, Danny Green used to lighten it up for the Lakers and used to light it up against us at St. Mary's, and for example. And I learned a ton from him growing up. I also played for Jerry Quinn at St. Thomas More, who was the, I'll say on record, is the best coach I ever played for, frankly. He understands the game. And then I also played for Gary Williams at University of Maryland, who's in the Hall of Fame. So, and all of those folks who, you know, those three gentlemen that were a part of my life definitely convinced me coaching resonated with my skills, resonated with my personality. And we also had a long history. So my dad had coached, I played at St. Dominic's with Ralph Willard, and, you know, the two of them had worked with Rick Pitino. Like, there was this, there was a whole cycle of that. I mean, Billy Donovan, I've known those guys when I was a little one. My dad was coaching Empire State Games when that was a big deal. So I was around it, and I was a junkie. Like, I really, really, really loved basketball. Like, I was the kid going to camp 10 hours a day. I was begging. I mean, these kids today are lucky to get quote unquote trainers. There was no trainers in my day. Like, I was out there watching a Steve Alford VHS with taping a broomstick to it. That's what all we had. And that was fine. I mean, I would get on a train from Babylon, New York, and go, I wouldn't even know, to Jamaica Station, and just walk off with a basketball, find a park and go do that. And a few kids were doing that from Long Island. And nowadays, I think there's more opportunities for kids, but that started to create my basketball mind. I had an idea about the way and style of basketball that I like to watch and I like to play, and I implemented it. I implemented it at St. John's, and I know it's a test lab in a sense, every team, and I like the technical part of the game and the strategy part of the game, and I was able to review with some of the best minds. And by year three at St. John's, we were really good. I started with a really young group of kids, and it took a long time. The style of play that I like to play, they're playing now, which is a five-man. Everybody can play every single position. It's an intellectual kind of game, but then you've got to do the skill to get there. And then I started getting really fascinating with team building, because I think it's such an underappreciated part of growing a team. And really, okay, as a interested in psychology, like, how do I do that? And I think I'd be better at that now than I was in my 20s and early 30s. Running camps is totally different. Running a business, being in the business of the game, is totally different than actually running a team. And my goal, frankly, was to wait till my daughter got a little bit older to get back into coaching, because I don't want to miss a thing, as they say. So she's four now. I'm going to wait till she gets into school full time and her own thing, because I want to be around. And I've seen it with enough of my friends that, and you guys know the time demands and consistency, and between that and my day job, it's almost impossible. So something has to sit on the side for a little while. But you never know. Every now and then I get a call, a friend gets a coaching job somewhere, and they're like, do you want to come? And none of them have really been the right fit at the right time. But if that happened, which I'm amazed by, because my hat has not been in the ring for anything, and I have not necessarily been coaching specifically. And these have been some decent jobs at the male and female level, in Division I basketball. So we'll see where how things go. I would love to be back in the game.
Thank you. Thank you. Also, I appreciate your Empire States. I participated in Empire States in 1995, and it was such a big thing. Yeah, I'm not too young.
Why are you my year? You look so much younger. Where was that? Because I played
Syracuse.
We
it was an amazing Olympic thing because you got to see the boxers and you got to see, and it was in the summertime, so it wasn't cold, and we had Kareem Reed. We had a couple of, you know, close friends and us city kids, because I'm from the Bronx.
Oh, okay.
We went to Empire, and it was like the biggest thing of our lives, because firstly, you got a chance to get away from your parents, and you're going on a college campus, and then, you know, of course you're not supposed to, but of course the college coaches are coming in to see you.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to start a thing where they bring Empire back. I know you coached me, you trained my guy Smush. Smush is a really good friend of mine.
Oh, tell him I said hello.
I will. But thank you for your answer. It's really appreciated.
Yeah. Smush is Kobe kind of killed Smush's reputation unfairly, because Smush, first of all, he's a big heart, but he was a basketball genius. In fact, you know, you go back to your original question about who shaped your mind, Rodney Parker was for a time one of my closest friends, if you can believe it. I used to sleep with on his couch. We used to go to games. Everyone knows what I'm talking about when I say Rodney Parker, the scout Rodney Parker. Like, Rodney found Smush. Rodney took Smush Parker. If you ever read Heaven is a Playground by Rick T. Linder, and you'll read about Smush Parker, I mean Rodney Parker, no relation to Smush Parker other than the fact that Rodney found him at West 4th and took him from West 4th to the NBA with 1 year at Fordham. And I was around for a lot of that stuff, a lot. And I worked with Smush a lot during those years. But Smush was a basketball, almost like a basketball genius. He's a facant. I don't know why he didn't last in the league. I think some of that is a little bit of time and place. But anyway, those were some good years, actually.
Yeah. Wow.
Glad you reminded me of that. I haven't thought about him in a while. Yeah.
Jay Griff, John Jay College.
Yeah.
You got a question for JD?
Absolutely. And amazing story. I can listen to it all day. I love your journey. Definitely, I'm sure you have some insane stories, but I'm involved with grassroots hoops as well. I would love to hear about like your day-to-day camps, just kind of how you structure them, and then what's your different challenges about language barriers.
So I'll answer the second question. The language is basketball. So no matter where I would go in the world, when I had the basketball, even in China where there was no English spoken at all, Italy, very little English, and a lot of the countries do speak English. But I mean, in India, English is the national language. But basketball itself is a communication tool, and kids are pretty, by the time I wasn't doing four-year-olds much longer. I mean, I kind of advanced to the time I was doing really 17, 18, and then pros, basically. So by then they knew. So it wasn't as much of as an issue. But if I was in that situation, I would try to, and I'm running a camp, let's say you got invited to go to Botswana, I'm just throwing that out there, and you had a local coach who did speak English, even if they're not a good basketball coach, they could help you communicate. That person comes with you, but it's how you prepare that person with what you're gonna do. So when I was running a camp, first thing, it was never cookie cutter. It really depended on what I was aiming to do. Like, I wouldn't train the Indian national team, Maccabi Tel Aviv, the same way I would train the junior national, or the same way I would train junior high school, right? So it really depends on the audience that you're doing. Regardless, I try to get three goals in. One is bring the energy, make it fun, and make the learning environment something that whomever you're working with is excited to be there. If you're just, and I was around a lot of coaches and some former Olympic coaches, and they would just come on the court and they were like, and it was like, yeah, you've done your thing. Congratulations. It's not, it's got to be a shared experience between you and someone else. On a technical standpoint, I always can find on the court, whether it's shooting, passing, ball handling, something at a higher level than the whomever I'm working with can do at a full speed. There's very few people in the world that can do things at the highest speed. In fact, one of the reasons why I think I was able to penetrate, and I never made it my real career or business, but work with some NBA talent, is because I know how to show guys how to use their body with the basketball to get, maybe it's only in a half an inch, but get, use the ball better to get closer to the basket. And that can go, that idea can go even a lower level. If you're working with a seventh grader, maybe they're not getting the ball high enough or something. So I'd always look for something technical. That would be the, you know, that would be the second thing. And the third thing, and I think it's underrated, is effort. And I don't think kids really understand effort at all. But if you can get that, you know, get that effort out of them to say, okay, we're going to be here for 45 minutes, and then communicating that. So however your day is structured, most camps start in the morning, they stretch, and then they jog, and then they ball handle, and then they do stations, and then they do this. To me, the most important thing is, what are you doing? Like, why are also, like, communicating to these kids? This is not conversations I would have with a lot of foreign coaches, especially once you won't, maybe you don't remember a time, but like, there was no YouTube, there was no, you know, there was just, there was no online way for people to learn. So there were videotapes sometimes. Most of these coaches were doing the drills, but not knowing why they're, first of all, not teaching it correctly and not their fault, but not, not knowing, why am I doing this drill? Why am I teaching a crossover? Or why? So you'd go and it'd be a really well-established coach within their domain, but, and they'd be doing ball handling drills, and all the kids, the ball's like here and this is here, and they're not. So I always found, and I could always typically find something, and that's just from being years and years and years on a court. I mean, and if you're like me, I mean, I learned 95% of everything in my life on a basketball court about people and everything else. So you as a coach, you mark on those, some of those things. And that's how I would approach the training. And it also, by the way, depend on the amount of time period. So if you have a week, or do you have 6 months, or do you have 3 years? So you can sort to gravitate. Because if it's your team that you're working in and you're trying to grow to something, like, for example, when I was coaching, when we were at St. John the Baptist, and I wanted to play fast, I wanted to play numbers basketball, get to 2-on-1, 3-on-2 fast breaks. That all sounds like fun and get, you know, but if you don't have a high level of skill and you can't get to point, it's actually very, it took a while with the team that I had to get them there. It took 2.5 years, right? I could have walked the ball up the court and told them, you guys set 9 screens and we probably would have won more games. But I wanted to get them to be as best. I wanted them to be the best they could be. And maybe that was my way of doing it. Doesn't mean it was the right way to do it. That was just my way of doing it. So I hope that was an answer to the question.
Yeah. Thank you. That was great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right.
Dan Murphy.
All right. Well, man, there's been a lot covered so far, and it's been really interesting. I think, this always happens where someone takes someone else's question. So you always have to be prepared with your backup questions. So I'm ready to pivot here, but I just wanted to jump in and kind of piggyback on a point that you talked about, that I always, you know, being kind of in a similar age as where you are and coming up playing basketball before this modern social media age, you know, I had like the Pistol Pete homework basketball VHSs. Like, I didn't have a trainer. I went out to my backyard or a park and just, you know, similar to what you were saying, you just like hopped on public transportation and went and found the game. And now we're in the era of AAU and trainers and the game, it's kind of changing a little bit. But, you know, that method worked for generations of players. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but it was just a different period of time. So I thought that was pretty cool. And obviously the international stuff is amazing. Now, one thing I've always kind of liked about kind of your career in a sense, whenever like I, you know, we have these conversations or think about what you've done, my mind definitely comes away expanded in a sense, because a lot of people in basketball get like focused in, locked in on one thing, like, oh, I'm just going to coach a team or I'm just going to be a trainer. But it looks like you've kind of used basketball to do a lot of other things in life. And I was just wondering if you could maybe like offer people advice, because, you know, with basketball, it becomes all consuming and you only see what's right in front of you, like win the next game or whatever, you know, plan for the next practice, whatever's like right in front of you. But there's a lot more to life outside of just that and your team. So if you could talk maybe like some of the stuff about business, like I only know one coach in college basketball that's doing anything entrepreneurial on the side. And he doesn't even talk about it. I just happen to know him and know that's what he does. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks. I was like, wait, like that's really smart. Like, it's such a volatile business. If anything happens, like this dude is good. Like he's got other things going on. So maybe if you could like offer people advice or talk about parallels between sports and business, I think it's just something coaches don't talk about enough, that there's more out there aside from the next practice, the next game, the next recruit. Like,
yeah, it's great you talked about that. So if there was a time, I feel like I'm a coach. Someone says, what do you do? In my heart, I'm like, I'm a coach, I'm a teacher. That's not what I do in my day job now. I made a pivot specifically for my family, for my future. I, for good or bad, I had a friend, and this is when I was in my late 20s, and we did a trip overseas together, clinics, and this is someone who won a championship as an assistant coach in the NBA. And was a head coach in the NBA, I would say. And let's say his finances were not great. I'm like, if this guy's finances are not great, what about me? Like, you know. And I started thinking about, well, the camps, I got lucky in a way too. I was in the camp world before they were, for good or bad, before they really got, and now everyone has a camp and everyone's a trainer. But back then it really wasn't there. And I was reorganized enough to run that into a decent enough business I put on the side. So when I had gotten back from India and I was trying to figure out what was next, my goal was, and by the way, separately from all of this, I had a real estate license as a broker in New York City, somewhere along that lines in the late 90s, I guess I got it. And I was selling properties on side. It really was on the side. It was friends would buy a loft or something downtown and I would, or sell a loft, they would use me. It was all relationship based. And that would fortify my income and my savings. And I got back from India and I decided not to go back. My wife was here. I didn't want to go to India for 6 months and leave and do what I was doing. I took a break. I took a little bit of a pause and I thought about where do I want to be in the next 40 years? And the reality is that, I mean, I grew up very middle-class kid in Long Island, no trust funds, no nothing. And you start thinking about risk or reward. So I thought that I would go back and restart the camps. But by that point, I had been in India for so long that I wasn't running a camp in New York anymore. And you would still have to reestablish yourself, no matter how good you are doing it. Any business takes 2-3 years to get started, which would have been fine. But I also learned, if you don't own the space in your camp, you really don't own it. You don't own a business. Twice, I built up a business and the landowner, so to speak, cut my lease, put it that way. And then they ran their own camp. Actually, 3 times that happened to me along the way. So I learned a little bit about that. So I said, maybe I need to build my own facility and run my own stuff. So I decided to go back to school. And I got my master's in real estate development for that purpose and finance at NYU. And that was a real turning point for me. First off, we didn't touch into it as much, but first time I went through university, Maryland. I was there as a basketball player, not a student. I never really had a chance to be an academic. And so for this time, for the first time in my life, I actually sat in a classroom, and I was like 35. Everyone else was like 28. I was like older. I'm big, you know, I'm 6'8". I'm sitting in this little classroom, like I don't fit, you know? And, but you know, by the end I was on scholarship because I had done, I'd done well in the school. And in the interim, I met my business partner, and together I was like, well, we could do this. We could start investing, because I was meeting people. And when you also get out in the world, you start to meet people, and you see what their life's like. I mean, we're meeting families that you can't even imagine. They're sixth generation landowners in Manhattan. I mean, think about that, going back to the Dutch. And you start to learn that business a little bit. So I decided, with my partner, we started a company called Silver Wave Equities, and we invest in apartment buildings. And we just finished our first ground up development project in the Bronx, fully leased, 100% affordable housing for New Yorkers who need it, using what's called low income housing tax credits, which is, it's not easy to do, but we were lucky. We had a great team, and it's fully done. 9 of the units are for homeless veterans. So I feel good about that. And we're looking for other projects and bigger projects. But this kind of business also allows you a little bit of freedom and time to do other things. And that was important to me, because no matter how much money you make, if you're not in a job and career that you love, you're kind of, for me personally, shutting off my life energy. And my North Star has always been to never work for anyone else, which I haven't had to yet to this point. I mean, I definitely answer to people, you know, from certain times, and I'm not the big man in charge all the time by any stretch, but I haven't had to work for anyone else, which allowed me the freedom to chase some things that I've wanted to. Some have worked, some have not. And there is a bigger world outside of the basketball. Don't get me wrong. If someone wanted to hand me the keys to the University of North Carolina, I'd pull it all down, and I wouldn't care, because I do think being a coach within some of these programs, it doesn't have to be North Carolina. It can be high school. It can be college. It doesn't matter. You can be in what they call an intrapreneur within what you're doing, right? Like, it's great. The thing is, I think Ball, what's his name, the guard from New Orleans, Lonzo Ball, he's like, I don't know the exact quote, but it's like, make the thing be your thing. Like, if you're really good at coaching and that's what you do and that's what you want to do, do that and be great at it and go with it. My sensibility, I thought I was pretty good at it at the time. I think you'd be much better at it now. But at one point, and not even beknownst to me, it was the biggest decision I was making. I started doing this other stuff that was taking me out of being a day-to-day coach. And I wrote that, and I think some certain conversations, like the one I had with the coach I mentioned before, nowadays, by the way, coachings make a much better living too. So I also had a family member, I should tell you, who was a college coach at Monmouth, by the way, and at Northeastern, Dennis Walsh. And Dennis lost his job at 45 and couldn't get another job. Like, he couldn't get another job. This was goes back about 20 years now, 25 years. And he ended up getting out of basketball. So I saw that. I saw the good stuff. We were around like the Patinos of the world and always on the top of TV. And at the time, we signed some crazy contract with the Celtics and all of that. And for me, it wasn't necessarily about the money. It was about the security and the freedom. So to do what I wanted to do. And that's, you know, you did make the decision to be a coach, especially at the college level. We know and high school, I shouldn't say. You're making sacrifices. You're making sacrifices with your time, your emotional energy, to your family, financially. You know, most coaches are very smart people. If they were in the business world, they could probably make more money unless you really make it to the top. And I saw that funnel. And that's what I did. What I do think is there's the coaches who actually get to the top. You know, I think of somebody like Steve Lavin. It would have been nice if Steve was on today. Who I got to know pretty well. We lived in the same neighborhood when he was coaching St. John's, so we'd meet for coffee and stuff. He's cerebral. He realizes there's a bigger world outside of basketball. And I do think that to connect with modern day athletes, you need to know, first of all, that the game is bigger than you, people are on your level and you have to approach the world in that way or you're going to be dismissed. You're going to be dinosaur. And you're seeing it. You're seeing it. You're seeing it. Some of the coaches got the memo. I think it started with Mike Rice, and I like Mike. He's a nice guy, but he was very verbally abusive. Those days are over, right? You see Greg, what the heck is Greg's last name at Wichita State? I mean, his day is probably numbered too. That world is changing. We got to change with it. We got to move with it. We got to take the conversation forward. And if you're not able to do that, whether you're an entrepreneur in coaching or an entrepreneur within coaching, then you're not going to have a, you're not going to be around that long. Because I have a feeling like when I started really researching it, I was lucky. Look, my dad coached and like Dean Smith would be in our living room. My mom making her lasagna, Roy Williams. Like I remember those days being a 5-year-old and seeing those guys, Dean Smith having a cigarette outside our front door, you know, like you're smoking. I can't believe it. You know, things like that. And as I got older, I started to read a lot of the books. These guys were not just about basketball. They were about diversity. They were about equality. They were about forward thinking basketball. And then I think if you have that plus the data that goes in and the ability and you know an intelligence to make decisions on the fly and motivate people, you have that whole package. I mean, you can do anything in the world, but you can for sure do a good job in basketball. You know.
No, that's awesome. Thank you. Appreciate that. That's definitely a great perspective on just, you know, this business as a whole, which, you know, for the love of the game, but then there's the business aspect side of it as well. So appreciate you sharing those experiences.
I'm naive to it, Dan, I'm not a little naive to it. Like I hear from some of my friends in college, this kid wanted money and this kid wanted money. And I'm still like, I was like, we never had any money. I mean, it was nice to get a scholarship and just go to school. But I do think like these kids are, by the time they come to college, they're pros. I mean, they're basically getting paid. They might as well start paying these kids. I know that wasn't your question, but I wanted to add that.
No, it is. When you talked about like the funnel, I mean, if you just look at everything that's happening now, obviously the financial aspect of universities being driven by the pandemic, like there's a lot of people losing their jobs, taking salary reductions. And if you've like never thought about doing anything aside from basketball, you have no backup plan. Well, where are you? You know, it's,
yeah. You know, they always talk about, oh yeah, these skills really transfer. But there's like, you think about it almost like a walking bridge. There's a missing link for so many players and coaches. They have the skills to do it. They just don't quite know how to do that, you know? And I think there's an opportunity for someone to come in and be a quote unquote coach or educator for a lot of these guys. And this is just my own. I have no insights on this, but the NBA, this is true though. The NBA and the NCAA and in college basketball and USA basketball, they might as well be this, you know, the hand in the same family. They all work together. They work in conjunction with each other. That's been proven. I think this pandemic is going to lead to a huge shakeup in college basketball. I think there's going to be a lot of Division I teams that are going to say, you know what, we're not making money. Why are we even having sports anymore? And you're seeing it. Look at Stanford. When Stanford doesn't have sports, you start thinking to yourself, wait a minute. I mean, their endowment's in the billions. So it's a write-off for them. And they're saying, we're not going to do it. I think you're going to see a lot of like D3 programs become super better. Like they're going to be more, the basketball is going to get better. And I think the NBA is going to come up with a G League where a lot of the top talent's just going to go there. And the kids that want to be in school with teams that can run their program as a business will continue. But I don't think everyone's going to survive from that. And I think the casualty might be Division II basketball, sadly. And other sports, obviously, like New York Tech, where I was working, they canceled the entire sports season this year, next year. I mean, Evan Conti did a fantastic job and now he's out of a job, you know, but that's, by the way, that's no different than a lot of people in the world. I mean, a lot of people come home on a Thursday and sadly their father come home, you know, or mother, breadwinner, loses their job and they're in business A and they're being retooled because of technology. right? I mean, technology is displacing people in any young coach today. If you don't know the data behind basketball and how to read it and how to implement it, the days of just feeling it out are kind of over. Like, yeah, there are some guys who are great motivators, but you better have somebody on your staff who understands like the data, because if you don't, you're not gonna win. We're smarter now. Like, whether you walk the ball up the floor or you run transition the whole time, people, you know, human beings, that's the thing about human beings, like, they keep growing, they get smarter, you know, and it's embedded in us to get better. But some people get hung on to the past and past ideas. You can hang on for a little bit, but, you know, but yeah, very few, by the way, like a Tom Izzo, I mean, very few.
Yeah, I think you've hit on so many great points, you know, with Dan's question, just about thinking about what people should do, like after the ball stops bouncing, you know, as that old saying goes, and then just how us as coaches, well, not just coaches, but people and players need to evolve with the game, you know, so you can bridge that gap. So I have one last question for you. Seeing it, you were doing some color commentary, you know, so you're still in the game, you know, you've been with the game and you've used the game for so many years. What do you think needs to be developed more in today's player?
You know what? This is probably an unpopular answer, but, and I thought I was pretty good in my day. I mean, I played a lot of top players, and before I got injured, I was kind of on my way to being, I think, really good. But I think the players today are much better than when we played. They're better athletes. They're better trained. They're better. And then people try to say, yeah, but their IQ isn't the same. I mean, that can be taught a little bit with coaches, but there's nothing you can't, you know, Smush Parker, 6'6" point guard, going to his opposite direction, uses his opposite hand, throws the ball cross court to Kobe, LeBron, and they're finishing it over like the outstretched hands of like Kevin Garnett. Like, you can't teach that stuff. But from a style of play, what I'd like to see more of the game, and this is just my own personal preference. If you look back to, I think, 2007, the Fighting Illini, Illinois, they had Kendall Gill and that whole team, five people, everyone handles the ball, shoots the ball, passes the ball. And in effect, that's what the Warriors did, actually, when they won the championships, is they played the quote-unquote small ball. I like that kind of game, frankly. I like when people can do everything on a court. But, you know, then all of a sudden someone's born like Anthony Davis and totally changed the game. So that's the great part of the game. It's like this chessboard that keeps going and going and going. I think kids work a lot harder now. I really do. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of these kids, they post the TikTok video of them shooting the ball. Like, really, the time it took you to post that, you could have taken 10 more shots. And there's that argument. But I also think, and this is more of a socioeconomic answer, the disparity of wealth, sadly, all economists will agree, is going to continue to rise, and there are going to be hungrier people, and there's going to be more money in the game. So, I mean, you just do the math. Like, what do you think is going to happen? There's more opportunities. There's more jobs. You couldn't go to Qatar in my day and make $300,000 playing basketball. I spent a lot of time in Qatar. Like, didn't exist. Yeah. Dominique Wilkins got like, you know, 600,000 or some number. I don't know the exact contract. Don't quote me. To go to play in Italy. And that was a big deal. And guys used to say, yeah, I'm going overseas. If you really knew, like, I have friends that played overseas for 12 years. They made 30,000 a year. They came back at 35. That's great. They had no money. Nowadays, this is only 10, 15 years later. There's more money in the game. And part of that has to do with the marketing. So if you think that the disparity of wealth, sadly, some because of policy, some because of data, is going to continue to grow, then it's a way out. It's a way for a better life for a lot of people. And I think that to do that, it'll be more competitive. And, you know, there are little things like the NBA changes the hand check rule, and then all of a sudden there's more scoring, right? So then this type of talent is preferred, or somebody like Jordan changed the game in a lot of ways, or Kevin Durant being so big and being able to do what he does changes the game. But I think the overall talent is better. And by the way, I think the coaching is better. I really do. I think coaches are better. I mean, in my day, you know, I was like third grade, played St. Joseph's CYO, Babylon, Long Island. And there was this old coach, and I remember he would say, run laps around the gym. He's smoking a cigarette. You know, he put one out on me one time, I remember, for Christ's sake, you know, and coming up, you could smell the alcohol on his breath. And like, if you got in trouble putting the medicine ball over your head and you're running, you know. And you think about it nowadays, where you have guys who play, what's the guy's name from UMass? Dana Dingle, right? Dana, is that his name? Dana's coaching. Like, he is a coach at youth level. Knows basketball, knows how to coach the game. We weren't getting that kind of connection. And by the way, games weren't even on TV as much. Guys can have the opportunity to watch games more. And people say, yeah, but they've got so many things, you know, they can't focus, they're on their phone and they're on this and they're on that. The kids that matter, that want it, they're locked and loaded. They are plugged in. And that's why those are the kids that I, especially like if anyone's working like 14, 15 year olds or even college kids, it's like, those are the ones I can work with. I don't care if you're last man on the team. It's so strange how every kid that I used to work out with that, and I would donate like 70 hours a week when I was St. John the Baptist, honestly, that was the other give back to getting my camp. So it's, nothing's free, by the way, but every kid that would be in the gym with me 5:30 in the morning got Division I scholarship. Do the math. It was open to everybody. So I still think that like that hard work will truncate anything. And I think the kids today and the cost of college too is going to force kids to want to become and be better. That's what I think. When I'm around my older guys, you know, some of my buddies, they won championships at Duke and they sit around talking and like guys, I mean, kids today are better. They're faster. They jump higher. They're just better. They're better. I don't know what you, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it's a ridiculous comparison when people go down the LeBron Michael route because they're too unique. You know, who's better, Michelangelo or Da Vinci? Like, I mean, they're both amazing. And LeBron had the benefit of Michael, right? So it's hard to say that. But I think generally as a median, players are like way better. Way better. And you know, a lot of coaches say, well, they play too much. They don't train as much. The game is playing. The game, at the end of the day, we all are about the game being better. The NBA game is about entertainment. Let's not confuse the two. The interesting thing is the Warriors brought it back to basketball. The game that was played in Orlando was basketball, in my opinion. Most NBA was not. I mean, I got so bored of watching the NBA. It used to be somebody dribble the ball up the floor, pass it, screen and roll, one dribble, two dribble, shot. I said, forget it. I'll put the game on with 3 minutes left, and the guys actually have to move the ball and do something. But now, watch Boston play. They move the ball. Watch even the Lakers. I mean, they were beautiful. The ball is moving. And that's what attracted me to European basketball. I mean, that could be another podcast. I spent a lot of time in Europe with the play over there and watching the game over there. And it's a different – It's a different game. It's to me, it's more of a high level five man game. NBA was about entertainment. Now that's changing. And I think part of it has to do because the players are young. You know, when you have a young player, they got to get to that second contract. They got to get on the court. So you do whatever you have to do. So the coaches have a little bit more leverage, unless somebody's really, really good. They're just going to take 30 shots a game. And that's rare for a rookie second year player.
Yeah. Yeah. And we didn't even touch upon your scouting that you've done. So we'll save that for part two when you're on. Elle, I think you have something you wanted to.
Oh yeah, I was just thinking about Dominique. I spent 2 years in playing in Herzliya, B'nai Herzliya.
Yeah.
And when I was in B'nai Herzliya, I was with Shaheem Holloway, and Dominique invited us to his house in Herzliya, and I'm like, what is Dominique Wilkins doing in Herzliya? And this is 2001. And when we walked into his house, he had an elevator in his house.
So cool.
And I mean, you know, being overseas as an athlete, especially in Israel, you don't pay taxes on your money. So it was grand and everything is given to you, and they don't have real high buildings, but the building that I was in, it just looked out, you know, and it was amazing, but I still couldn't believe it. I'm like, Dominique, what are you doing over there? He was like, I'm making more money here now than I did my last 4 years in the NBA.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it. But just to piggyback on that, Dominique, and also I realized that I wasn't as good as I thought I was when I went overseas and played because of what you stated about, like, the defense, like, that's structured, the defense. Or the offense, you have to be able to move it. And I was at the highest level. So you get two Americans. It was two Americans. And then at this time, this is when I blew out my knee and I got cut from the Sparks. And I'm going against everybody that's in the WNBA that I just got cut from. So every night you're challenging yourself and you're like, you know, I got to get in. But then when you're on that level, you're like, okay, do I want to really do this? And, you know, that was just like a come to light moment for me, the hard work, you know? So you just brought back some memories.
So many great points. I mean, once you have that question, that's your answer. You start asking yourself that question, do I really want to do this? And then when it's something you've loved since you're probably 2 years old and you play at a high level. But it ends for everybody, right? It ends for everyone. It's going to end for LeBron with how many championships, but it's going to end for some people in junior high school. It's, you know, it ends. The hard thing, at least for me, maybe you as a competitor, is that it ended before I really wanted it to. I didn't get the choice. I mean, even Carmelo said that. He's like, everyone doesn't get the chance to end when they want to. And you're like, this guy's been awesome.
Well, I was lucky enough to have West Forth and go beat down on those girls.
Yeah, but you're still
doing it. I haven't played in a couple of years, but when I knew my professional career was over, I was down like Smush was at West Forth and just taking it out on people. And, you know, and after a while, it's like, this is not fair. You belong somewhere else. But no, I enjoy it. Like at that point, when you realize that you're not at the level you need to be at, you come down and you start to enjoy it more. And that's what allowed me to do other things.
Well, I'll tell you, for me, you know, and I had a back injury, which really hurt me. But like, I was playing in New York Athletic Club. We had these runs and up until about, I was 33, 34 years old. And there'd be like 6-7, pros on the court. I could hide myself. Like, as I got a little older, I could hide in the corner. Ball came to me, I could shoot, I could make a shot. I could tell you, you know, give guys like a foot or two and put a hand in their face. They make it, they don't. I could run up and down and not make a mistake, put it that way. And then one day I just twisted my ankle. And I'm like, what am I doing? These guys are training all day. Like, what are you doing, man? Like, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And it was very unceremonious, honestly. You know, you kind of lucky you get what you get. If you got to go out with a little fanfare and they put your jersey up somewhere, that's like, it's it, you know? But when you're living through this stuff and it's happening all around you to your peers in some ways, it's like, it's kind of expected. But the reality is this is it. This is it. Unless you make so much money that you're set for life. But the best, better than all of that is you're still in it. Now you're giving it back. I don't know if you coach girls or boys at your school, but you're coaching. You're giving your experience. Like, I mean, that's amazing.
Boys.
Oh, you coach boys. I thought you did. Yeah, and you're giving it back. You know, I mean, that's special. That's the cycle of life. I mean, we all want to be part of the life and someone else's. Look, we're only on this planet for so long. No one wants to think about it, but we're only here, but for so long. So what can we give to other people that they can take? And then they take it and then give it to someone else and it goes, but you're a piece of that. And that's pretty special, you know, that's pretty special. And that wouldn't have happened, by the way, had you not had that thought in Herzliya. You didn't even think about that. Or had you not got cut by the Sparks, you know, maybe you wouldn't have been as good a coach because of that. And you have there's a bigger purpose for you. But it's a lot on what you decide to do with it. We have that free will, right, to go do that. That's pretty, pretty, pretty great story, though. It's all a great story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. I don't think I knew that you were in Herzliya, but I mean, I got a ton of family in Herzliya, so we'll meet up there one time.
Next podcast is in Herzliya at Dominique's house.
Yeah, from Dominique's house, absolutely. JD, I want to thank you so much for taking your time today and sharing your story about the game and what you've been able to do because of basketball. I think it's, you know, as I said at the beginning, it's an amazing journey. And just sharing, you know, what you know about the business side and everything.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It was fantastic to Al and Jason to meet you for the first time. And Dan, always a pleasure. It's been too long.
It has. Likewise. Yeah. Always good to see you.
I was going
to
come out with
my heart. Thanks for coming on.
But I didn't want to scare anybody.
Thanks for listening to the Basketball Coaches Roundtable Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter @BCRPodcast11.